Hello everyone, my name is Louisa Morse. I am the Division Chair of STR, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this event on the relevance of formal theoretical work and strategy. This event is the first in a series we will be running this academic year on the impact and relevance of strategic management, hence the background on impact and relevance. In many of the events, like the one today, the sessions will involve conversations with strategy practitioners, and I'm sure we're going to have an interesting conversation. So thank you very much to the panelists for being here and participating, and also to my co-organizing, Kroon Heimerix, for helping organizing this event. I'm going to hand over to Kroon now to introduce the event and today's speakers.
Thanks so much, Louise. Wonderful. Also, on my behalf, a great welcome to our panelists, to our participants. It's wonderful to have you here. And hopefully this is going to be an enriching experience for you as an STR member. And Louise, wonderful. Thank you for the support and making this happen, you know, as our STR division chair. So I'm Kroon Heimerix. I'm the STR executive committee member who's organizing together with Louise the event. Our panel contributors of today are Christina Fang, who's professor of management and organizations at NUI Stern. We have Martin Reeves as a second speaker, who's the chairman at the BCG Henderson Institute, the think tank at BCG. We have Mike Ryle, who's a professor of strategic management at Toronto. And we have Phoebe Wibbins, who's assistant professor at INSEAD and our 2023 SDR Emerging Scholar winner. So it's wonderful to once again to welcome you all. This is part of a series of virtual events that STR is organizing that we're offering for our members. The events are recorded and posted on our YouTube channel, which we invite you to visit, should you be interested in watching many more of the events that we organize for you. Today's session is obviously one in a series, and it's the first on rigor and relevance, which is particularly organized around the relevance of theoretical work and strategy, as we just kindly announced. The key intent for the session is to explore new ideas and thinking into the relevance of formal theory. You know, just as a little backdrop, right, there's an interesting tension, I think, in our field going on. On the one hand, we have formal theory and rigorous methods and econometrics becoming more and more important. At the same time, there is a big push for relevance in our scholarly work. This is what this very session is about. How do we morph those two together? And should we or should we not, you know, be pursuing that? Today's panel will discuss these important questions. Each panelist has 12 to 15 minutes to present, after which we'll do a Q&A. You can obviously post any questions meanwhile you have in the chat box, so please make use of that if you would. And I will be keeping the time. And without further ado, Christina, can I invite you to open up and share your thoughts with us, please? Thank you.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you for the organizers for the invitation. And let me start. So the title of my quick talk today is the relevance of formal theoretical work in strategy. And if the question is it relevant? Then the answer is absolutely yes. One does not need to go further than the classic work published by Jim March in 1991, titled The Exploration Exploitation in Organizational Learning, to have a great example of impactful and relevant theoretical work in management. As you can see here at the bottom, it has been cited by over 32,000 articles, so clearly has made a lot of impact in our field. The basic idea of the paper is this introduction of this fundamental trade-off between exploration and exploitation into the management literature. So although exploitation, right, as you can see here, is hitting the nail at the head, right? It's considered exploitation. While it yields more certain and immediate returns, it makes a discovery of truly novel solutions very unlikely and can lead to obsolescence in the long run. This is an idea that has been put forward by Holland in 1992. So Jim really introduced this idea to the management literature, and he argued that while exploration can enable the discovery of profoundly novel solutions, it also typically can cause a degradation of performance in the short run because searches for novel solutions usually fail, right? So exploration into outer space, into other galaxies, unlikely to yield immediate benefits and yet may be crucial for the long-term survival of our species. So given this intriguing idea that is so fundamental to a lot of what we are thinking about in the management literature. Jim March basically operationalized these two concepts in very innovative ways. So he operationalized exploitation as learning fast, right? The speed of learning is very fast. You copy best performing ideas very efficiently, very quickly, very efficiently, right? But that could lead to premature convergence on the homogeneous set of ideas and therefore lower overall performance. Exploration, he operationalized as learning slow. Now, slow learning, very inefficiently learning the best performing ideas. This actually counterintuitively allows the organization to preserve more diversity of individual ideas and therefore can lead to higher overall performance in the long run. So these ideas can clearly have been highly impactful, and March really used a very simple and yet very formal model to illustrate some of these ideas, and has made a lot of important has made a lot of important subsequent work possible. So what is theory? What is formal theory, and what is good formal theory? I'm going to use two quick examples to just give some preliminary answers. I'm going to use a map of New York City, as well as this book cover. This is a book written by Leif and March in 1975 called The Introduction to Models in the Social Sciences. I'm going to use these two examples to illustrate my tentative answers. So as you can see here, this is a map of subway system in New York City, right? I'm going to ask all of you, in what sense this is a good map? Maybe pause for 1 minute, okay? Or maybe 1 second, okay? How, in what sense this is a good map? Well, it is a good map because it tells you how to get from point A to point B if you need to take the subway, right? What line, what number subway you need to take, and what roughly you, what are the areas that you can get to. So in that sense, it's a very good, concise map that tells you how to take the subway systems or use the subway systems in New York City. My second question is, in what sense is this a bad map? Okay, it is a bad map because it doesn't tell you everything you need to know, right? So if you, let's say you wanna go from point A to point B in New York City, this map only tells you how to get there roughly by the subway. What if you need to walk? What if you need to take the buses? What if you need to take the cab, right? So the map is not detailed enough to tell you everything that you need to know in order to move from point A to point B in New York City. So in that sense, it is a very bad map. All models and all theories are just like maps. They are most useful when they contain the details of interest and deliberately ignore others. So in that sense, models contain very simplified, very abstractive features of reality known as small worlds. Okay, so to give you an example, this is the two characters talking to one another in one of the famous children's book. One character said, well, we actually made a map of the country on the scale of 1 mile to 1 mile. And I inquired, have you ever used it much? It has not been spread out yet, right? The farmers objected. They said that it would cover the entire country and shut out the sunlight. Okay, so it's not a map if it's not useful as a map if it's 1 mile to 1 mile. In other words, if it's an exact replica of a reality, that's not going to be useful at all, right? Because it doesn't help us anyway, right? If it's as complex as reality itself. So formal theories and formal models are not meant to be exact replicas of reality. They help us understand reality by breaking reality down one piece at a time. Right? So simple models never really come close to capturing all the important details of the real world. Okay, so in that sense, all models are by definition wrong. Right? And yet they provide internally consistent formal account of what could explain the observation of interest. And they help us think about the problem, to get a point across, to communicate what we are thinking, and no model is exact. Right? So I made a point that models are not, by definition, bad models of reality because they cannot capture everything that is relevant in reality. Now, what is good model then? I'm going to use this book to draw from this book and give you some quick ideas. So according to Leif and March, a good model is is basically a broad and powerful statement about the world, right? It needs to be simple, elegant, and provocative. So here I'm using the words model, theory, framework, and ideas very much interchangeably. Okay, so this book, I really think that it should be a one semester study of any PhD student education, okay? But it also proposes a process model of how do we build theory? How do we build good models? So note the first step here. The first step of any theory building is observation, right? Is observing some empirical facts, empirical regularities that you try to explain. Right. Only after you make those observations, then you motivate your entire theory building exercise. Okay. Then you ask yourself, what unknown process or model could have produced these facts, these empirical regularities? Can you deduce other end results from the model? Are there other implications? If not, can we produce a new model? And in the end, we're going to generalize. This is a very good process model of theory building. So I'm going to give you two examples here, and I highly encourage everyone to try these yourself, right, by following the steps here and try this yourself offline. So for example, take the empirical observation of that I took from the book, okay? Automobile drivers rarely smile. If you study the faces of drivers as they pass, you see an unrelieved series of somber people, right? This is an empirical observation. And what theory and what model can you propose to explain this? Right? And if you follow all the steps that I highlighted before in the last slide, what can you come up with? And next exercise, the second exercise is most people respect doctors more than lawyers. Why do you think could explain? What do you think could be a model that can explain this particular empirical regularity? Right? So there are hundreds and hundreds of examples from the book. Highly encourage everyone to do that in the end, okay? Offline. So I think I'm made the point clear that formal theories are by definition relevant, right? They're motivated because they're, at the very beginning, they're motivated from empirical observation. So they are relevant to an empirical regularity, and yet they do not seek to replicate reality, right? So there's a limit as to any single model, any single theory can do, because it cannot capture by definition everything that is important about reality. So in the remaining two or three minutes, I'm going to use a good example from my own work, just because I know them better. I'm going to use my own draw from my own work to illustrate this process of theory building. As I mentioned before, the classic paper by March 1991 is really highlighting the trade-off between expertise and expectation. And in particular, he zoomed in on the speed of learning as a potential lever that organizations can use to tune the balance between expertise and expectation, right? High speed of learning, fast speed of learning is a proxy for exploitation, and slow speed of learning is a proxy for exploration. So then we can ask, what are some of the other features of organizational life empirically observed that could influence the relative balance between exploration and expectation? So that's a question that I ask in several other papers together with my co-authors. So if you go to the MARCH model, you know that a feature of that model is that individuals only learn directly from the code and not from one another. So we all learn individually from the code and not from one another. But that's not quite realistic if you think about empirically, right? Empirically, we all learn intuitively from our friends, from other similar situated individuals, and maybe not so much from the code, okay? So what can we do? So can we incorporate this particular feature, this particular empirically realistic feature into the MARCH model and see whether, you know, any difference can be made? So we basically get rid of the organizational code and then allow individuals who previously cannot learn from one another now the ability to learn individually from each other. So once you allow for individuals to learn from each other, then the interaction pattern and the communication pattern, their connection pattern matters. So in two related papers, I study how these kind of patterns influence organizational learning, very much similar, very much, you know, just introducing this network connection pattern to the basic MARCH model. So in this paper published in 2010, we ask, are, you know, cross-group linkage, group for organizational learning. If you think about individuals situated in groups, and each group have sometimes sparse links with one another groups, we find that a small number of cross-group links, as you can see, these are red links, are actually going to be the best perform. Actually going to be associated with the highest levels of performance, because they really allow you to capitalize on the learning within each cave, but also allow you to access distant ideas from other parts of the organization. And very much similarly, in a paper published four years later, we broadened the kind of network connection patterns from uniform distribution of links to more varied distribution links. Some networks, some organizations could have very democratic distribution of links. Some other organizations may be dominated by a few connected individuals that are hubs. Okay, so we study sort of if you can tune this by one parameter and then generate a variety of different network patterns, what's going to be the most best performing network pattern? And we find that is neither the hubby networks nor the democratic networks. It's some kind of in between again. Moderately connected hubby networks perform the best, right? So these are two very quick examples of how we can build on the classic MARCH model by introducing sort of realistic features of organizations that we observe in reality and make the models much more convincing and much more persuasive as well. So I'd like to end my quick presentation by saying that building formal model/theories is actually very fun. And I highly encourage everyone to take this book seriously. It's an old book, and really take the do the exercises and really learn from this fundamental and yet beautiful and fun ideas. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions later on. Okay.
Thank you so much, Christina. That was wonderful. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and for linking it so nicely to some of this wonderful foundational work and your thoughts on formal theory. Let's move to Martin if we could.
Can you hear me okay? Good. Well, thank you for inviting me, sort of a pseudo-practitioner, to give a perspective on this question. I say pseudo-practitioner because I'm in a consulting company, but I do research in BCG in order to anticipate new theories and issues that clients may need. I actually find this question very strange, and the fact that we're even asking it, let alone holding a session on it, I think says something about the field. And I mainly want to explore what does it say about the field. Clayton Christensen, I think an influential theoretician on practitioners, said in a meeting I attended of his in IMD a few years ago, that managers are voracious consumers of theory. There is no, in the practice of strategy, there is no separation between strategy and theory. And I think that's my experience. Clients have to be curious about changes in the world. They have to adopt new perspectives to understand and exploit those phenomena and to gain advantage. So why do we ask this question? Clearly, there's some sort of separation that says that the theoretical work needs justification. When we talk about relevance of theory, I think what we're talking about in an applied discipline like medicine or engineering or strategic management is relevance to practice. And I think there's a synergistic relationship in a healthy discipline between practice and theory, whereby theory is informed by practice. In other words, it targets ultimately useful questions and phenomena of practitioners. It provides a language for discussing those new phenomena, and it triages different explanations. Christensen talked about theory value, a concept I use a lot, which is to say a theory doesn't merely describe, it discriminates between alternative explanations and alternative courses of action. And also it informs practice in the sense that it highlights phenomena, it poses questions, and practice serves as a test bed for theory. So in an applied discipline, really, we don't need to ask this question. So why do we ask this question? I carried out a straw poll in the Hyderabad meeting of the Strategic Management Society on the relevance of strategy. It's a small sample, 77 participants, but it's I've since done repeated the work with a larger sample. And the numbers on the right don't look too unhealthy, except if you see that this is the percentage of respondents disagreeing with the statement. And bear in mind that this is mainly academic strategists. So 81% of academic strategists in the Hyderabad meeting, I think, which is reasonably representative, do not see strategic management, strategy research as useful to practitioners. 76% do not see the strategy work that's being undertaken in universities as not being based on interchange between academics and practitioners. So I think what is in question is not really the relevance of theory. It is the connection of the world of theory to the world of strategy. So this is I've looked at this as part of my own profession in some collaborative work with the SMS, and I mean, it seems to me that compared to engineering or medicine, in the learning cycle of exploration and exploitation that Christina referred to, we have various breakages relative to those other healthier disciplines. One of them is that we have insufficient dialogue between the world of practice and theory, leading to, of course, to an inability to work on the very latest data, on the very latest phenomena, to have a really good understanding of what practitioners are looking at, and also to establish the relevance of theory in that dialogue. I think we see a lot of inertia in the research agenda. If you look at the quoted papers in academic research, or at least in the areas of strategy I'm familiar with, we're still quoting very old papers predominantly, and PhD students tell me that there are obstacles to undertaking completely novel courses of action. There is alignment with the interests of professors. There are considerations about what will gain professional credit and promotion. So some sort of inertia in the research agenda. I think one of the big ones is potentially pursuing innovation as an end in itself. In other words, when the theoretician's main audience is theoreticians, there is an interesting game for the theoreticians occurring, but it's not primarily a dialogue with practice. So it becomes an end, a sort of a glass bead game in its own right. I think an overemphasis on quantification, my personal opinion would be that that's a limitation. Strategic management is not physics, it's multivariable, emergent, complex systems. I think that if we restrict ourselves to elaborate statistical analyses of trivial propositions, I think we achieve a certain level of objectivity, but we also lose something in terms of the usefulness of the theory. I think that the I used to think that it was me as a practitioner that had a hard time reading the typical sort of exhaustive statistical treatment of an obscure area, or sort of a typical paper in strategy. But then I discovered, talking to my academic colleagues, that actually, no, this was not a particularly good way of communicating, even for them. So I think the obscurity and the formalism of the communications can be an obstacle to the propagation of messages. And I often hear, I think, also a conflation of formality and rigor. Rigor does not require obscurity. I think sort of formality and logic and persuasiveness are possible with accessibility. It's a false trade-off. So what can we do about this? I think if we take this sort of straw man of the trade-off between the relevance of theoretical work, the rigor of theoretical work, and the accessibility of theoretical work, I mean, it seems to me that if we take medicine or engineering, the claim would be that this is an artificial distinction, and that we really can break these trade-offs. We can have things which are timely, relevant, and understandable as well as being rigorous. And I won't go through these one by one, but some of the things we can do, I think, at the level of the Academy of Management are to get into the world. How many practitioners do we have in our meetings? Is the format conducive to their participation? Are we soliciting them for the latest questions and phenomena that they are struggling with so that they can have ultimate relevance? Are we looking at the incentives that inform the choice of the objects of theory to ensure their eventual relevance? Are we testing ideas in practice? Is there a regular flow of ideas and people between theory and practice, or is it too easy to identify the two crowds? Remember that in the early days of strategy, this very young discipline we call strategy, which was founded in the on the East Coast of America in the early 60s, there was really little distinction between theoreticians and practitioners. And I think on communication, I think I was reminded by a senior once of a very important message, which was, I'm not in the business of truth or theory. I'm in the business of communication and dialogue around things that matter. So really, we should strive for excellence in communications. And it seems to me that any paper should be readable. The introduction should be absolutely readable. It should be well propagated. It should be well discussed. There should be a short version. There should be a LinkedIn post. There should be a tweet. And there is nothing trivial about communicating clearly. I think one of the key things that we'll maybe get into in the Q&A is thinking about this concept of trading zones. What does it take for theoreticians and practitioners, ideally across disciplines, not within narrow disciplines, to actually communicate with each other? You have to create like a medieval trading port where people with different languages can actually communicate, and that's not a trivial thing. If the requirement to attend an AOM meeting is a 30-minute presentation with full academic rigor, mainly addressed to people in one discipline, then I think that the ideas will not travel, and an idea which doesn't travel, I think we can reasonably describe as a self indulgence. So finally, let me show you that I'm taking some of my own medicine, or at least attempting to. So one of the things that that I do is to try to convene academics and practitioners, CSOs, in order to have what I call a strategy radar meeting, where the theoreticians say, this is what we think we should be working on, this is what we are working on, and the practitioners, the CEOs and the CSOs say, well, you know, here are the most important issues that we don't even have a word for. Here are the things that we don't understand, and we have a real dialogue about what we should all be working on. And ideally, this is early days for this format, but ideally, this will foster a new form of a dialogue that will heal the rift hinted at in the question. So let me pause there.
Great, thank you very much, Martin. Wonderful. Very kind of complimentary and great to learn your thoughts and these ideas. Wonderful. Indeed, I think setting us up for a wonderful set of questions too. Can I invite Mike, please?
Absolutely. So just to explain to the audience, my sharing isn't working. So Louise is sharing my slides for me here. Great. So, you know, this is a discussion that I've been involved in since the beginning of my career. And in some sense, I'm going to agree with Martin completely and even maybe take it a step further, that it may be a little bit unfair to require people to answer the question, why is your methodology relevant to practitioners, when the field itself is resistant to the methodology. I don't sit in a lot of panels where people are saying, you know, is empirical work relevant to strategy, for example. So I have basically three, and I would like to focus on the field, but also bring it back a little bit to practice. So I have three answers to this question. So let me give the first answer. So Louise, if you could advance. So answer number one is yes, formal theory is not only relevant to generating important principles and strategy, it's a necessity. So I just organized an interdisciplinary conference that occurred over the weekend on empirical design and causal inference. And it was sort of unique in the sense that it involved, it was interdisciplinary. So we had biologists, we had, people from Netflix and practitioners, we had economists, computer scientists, machine learning people, and so on. And one of the big questions that people are asking and thinking about in a big way in all of those fields is how we make sure that the empirical work that we do is actually accurate and has external validity. From a theorist point of view, what I see mostly in our field from an empirical research design perspective is someone has some relationship that they're interested in between a couple of variables, and then they measure every variable, they collect data on every variable they can that has any relevance or connection to the variables of interest, because there's this misconception that just sort of throwing more variables into an equation is better in order to remove omitted variables bias. So you see this all the time. And next slide, please. But this isn't right. So sometimes this is right, sometimes it isn't. So the structural causal modeling field in computer science, and now it's spreading all over the place, is sort of thinking very carefully about when it is the case that throwing variables into a regression equation are actually going to remove omitted variables bias. And here are some simple examples of when that would be the case. So we're interested in the relationship between X and Y, and when we measure the variable Z, and these simple little graphs are intended to represent the true data generating process, U would be an unobserved variable, that if you do in fact measure Z and put it into your regression, then you will remove omitted variables bias. But, next slide please, that is not always the case. And here's some examples of data generating systems that would actually introduce or amplify bias. And there are just any numbers of variations on this theme. You can be introducing bias, you can have no effect on the variable, you can screw up precision. I mean, there's sort of all kinds of problems that can arise if you are not thinking in advance about your empirical design. Now you notice that this is very simple, but these graphs are formal objects. And the implications as to why you might want to include or not include a particular variable are implied by formal theory. So these are all, you might argue, qualitative, but the graphs are formal objects. And there's no getting away from someone needing to think this through before they run around, collect data, and start doing regressions on things. And in fact, if they are just sort of throwing everything into their regression, I would say there's an overwhelming probability that the things being estimated are simply not correct. So in my view, and I think in the growing view of the community and econometricians and others that are working in this field, an empirical paper that does not somewhere in it give the author's theoretical view of the causal system generating those data and why that empirical design makes sense, basically isn't worth the paper it's written on or the pixels that it's stored on. So, you could ask the question, why is empirical work relevant? You need to have a theory. Now, I'm not, one thing that you could be doing if you have a theory like this is you could be trying to do the causal identification and actually test whether this structure is the correct structure. And certainly a lot of people do that. And there are a lot of methods for that. But even if you don't do that, it is incumbent upon you to tell us what your causal theory is and why these variables are being included and why they make sense. And if that's a compelling story, then, we have some reason to think that we should pay attention to the causal results. So I would say that, right out of the box, we can make an argument that, again, at least this level of formal theory is necessary to sort of make sense of anything. All right, so the first answer is a very strong yes, and at least at this level of theory. Okay, next slide. Oh, sorry, next slide is, by the way, there. I assume that, you will at least be posting the video, if not also the slides. And these are just some citations for people that might be interested in this burgeoning work. I would point out that Uta Pearl has a number of books on this that are fantastic. Jose Penalva and I have a paper on actually taking extensive form games in game theory and translating them into these objects so that you can see the empirical implications of these game theoretic model, if that's what you're doing. And there are even a couple of papers arguing in favor of this in the management literature, Lee 2021 and Lee and Bettis 2023. And I would direct you to Sinelli et al. 2022 for a really fantastic summary for empirical people of these issues. So that's there. All right, next slide. So the next answer to, you know, is theory relevant goes back to what Christina was saying. And the answer, in my view, mainly is yes, because it introduces novel insights that you simply wouldn't have otherwise. So the value capture stream in strategy, which Joshua Gans and I summarize at least up to 2017 in our review paper, points out that the mainstream view and strategy, the stuff that we're teaching pretty much uniformly, is Porter, 1980, we do our industry analysis, and then Barney or variations on Barney, which is this sort of VRAN idea, all of which is aims to explain why are there persistent performance differences between firms and across industries. And so this literature, and I was in it for a lot of the development of it, was really a response to these economic models of perfect competition. And so the inherent sort of main idea backing these models up is that persistent performance differences require some barriers to competition. So what's interesting about this is that these writers sort of assume the premise from the perfect competition models that they don't like by saying, well, you know, if there were no barriers to competition, then we would see sort of no profits and homogeneity and returns and so forth. So because we don't see that, it must be the case that there are these barriers to competition, and what would they be? And we've got, you know, all of these models. Next, please. And in 1996, we begin to get these value capture theory, which is formal theory and it's fairly general. And I think that's probably the work that I would be most known for, that starts coming along going, well, wait a minute, you know, this isn't quite right. We need to think about it more. And some ideas start coming out that are just completely missed by verbal theorizing. So one is this very basic idea that you need to, think about the distinction between creating value and capturing value, that's important and you need to think about it. The second is that we hear all the time people talking about the need to create value, businesses need to create value. And there's a question, well, what exactly do you mean by that? And Brandenburger and Stewart in 96 and sort of their very important pioneering paper have a definition of added value. And that seems to be an appropriate and important way to think about how your business is creating value. And then McDonald and Ryle come along and go, well, wait a minute, you know, the guys that have been working in response to the perfect competition problem actually haven't gone far enough, right? So we're actually going to just reject the whole premise and note as a result of doing that there's good competition. So it isn't just a question of having barriers to competition because competition will eventually corrode your profitability. But in fact, there can be competition for you as much as there can be competition against you. And understanding how competition for you works and, you know, trying to make that happen for you leads to competition actually raising your take. And so this is a sort of another idea that was just completely not on anyone's radar. And then finally, one of the other things that comes out of the formalism is that competition isn't determinative. So we sort of have this deep intuition basically from our intermediate economics of supply and demand and Cournot and Bertrand and so forth, the competition determines some point value, and therefore, you know, it's fully determinative. And what this theory says is, well, wait a minute, that's not exactly right. You can go anywhere from having no competition, in which the participants to a transaction are just haggling with each other over what the split to be, to the other extreme, where competition really does determine everything, and essentially there isn't really any haggling to be done at all, other than pointing out your competitive alternatives. But in general, there's probably some range of potential appropriation or value capture for a business. And therefore, when that's the case, there's something that determines how much you get within that interval. And that identifies the importance or potential importance of persuasive resources. This is, you know, again, something that is just not studied, not on anyone's radar, not thought about. So I would say that, you know, this is just an example of, and I think there are others, but it's the one I'm most familiar with, of just a number of insights that actually are quite important, both to the field and to practitioners, that arise from someone going through the formal exercise. Okay, next slide. Okay. And then this goes to Martin's point in a big way. There's another answer, which is no. And the answer is no, because the profession determines what's quote unquote relevant. So we can say, this is so relevant. This is really relevant. You know, you really have to pay attention. Here's all the reasons that you really need to pay attention to formal theory. But, you know, if the field is just uninterested in that, it's not relevant. Next. So I would say I've been at this for 25 years, as many of my colleagues here know, and others have been as well. And I would say from when I started in the late 90s, there is some good news, right? So after hammering away at this for 25 years, you know, when I first started and into the early 2000s, a paper with a formal model in it just got desk rejected. And I can tell you, you know, it took me years to get one publication out the door. I came into the field thinking, oh, everyone's going to love this. You know, my economist colleagues are going to be like, wow, this is so, you know, rigorous. And my strategy colleagues are going to be so happy that I'm, you know, really getting at the questions that they're interested in. And of course, what actually happened was everybody didn't like it, because economists are saying, why are you looking at those questions? They don't seem interested. And strategy people were saying, we don't want to see formal models. And so it took a long time. But today, all of the mainstream journals will publish formal theory, even AMR. So if you told me AMR was going to be publishing formal theory papers in the late 90s, I would have never believed it. So in a way, that's a big win. And we have a new generation of people who are pushing these methods. You know, Yue, I noticed that you're actually on, and Lena Plaxenkova's are also people who are really, you know, working hard to continue the evangelization. So there's been progress, but next. If you could do the next, yeah. But nevertheless, within our field, the reality is the audience for this kind of work is very small. Especially for general theory, it's slightly better for special models that attend to some particular thing. Rich McAdock has a formal theory paper that has something like over 4,000 citations, but that's really the exception that proves the rule. These papers are not widely cited. They're not widely read. There's very little impact on the empirical side, and there's basically no impact on teaching or practice. So I've been teaching undergraduates and for an undergraduate class, you kind of need a textbook. I'm using mainstream textbooks, and they just end in 1991. You know, it's as if everything we discovered that we need about strategy was discovered up to 91, and nothing new has happened since then. And it's very frustrating, because they're conflating ideas and things aren't really clear, and, you know, trying to teach from them is very difficult. I would agree with Martin that when I teach executive MBAs and I teach some of this value capture ideas, they are all over it. You know, it isn't hard to convince business people. Are always looking for advantages and new ideas. So they've all had their quarter. They've all had their resource-based view. They come into an executive MBA program and they are really happy to see new ideas. But, you know, trying to convince the field is just simply very, very hard. The field is very resistant to this. So you know, as Martin said, why are we still having, why are we still having these discussions? You know, we still are. And I, you know, I fear that, that the field is really sub-optimizing in terms of their engagement with formal theory. And that is that. Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. All, you know, greatly timed as well. Great, great contributions, Mike. I really appreciate your thoughts on our formal theory and riches, you know, modeling empirics. You know, great, great contribution as well. Let's move to FIBO.
Sure, I'm off mute. Can you hear me? Great. My name is Fabio Wibbens. I would describe myself as a physicist in management. And today I'm going to talk about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the sciences, which actually is a play on a physics paper from 1960. You might not realize it every day, but actually math, formal and computational models really play a critical role in modern life. Maybe the clearest example is in microprocessors, right? Like microprocessors are based on semiconductors. Semiconductors, you need like quantum mechanics, highly mathematical, both like very formal theory in quantum mechanics, but also all kinds of simulations of figuring out what are the right semiconductors. Also, for instance, a navigation system uses Einstein's general theory of relativity. You might think general relativity is something of the stars out there, like far across my field, like really heavy math stuff. But your GPS would be completely off if it didn't make the general relativistic corrections for it. It would go wrong very, very quickly. And also in business life, math plays a very important role. Just think of any merger, acquisition, or capital investment made for that matter, which builds on the CAPM, right? The capital asset pricing models, like the finance people need to determine the cost of capital, what are the betas. This plays a fundamental role in today in key business decisions. So math is really clearly very fundamental throughout the sciences. But mind you, this hasn't always been this way. This idea that math can do something for you in the sciences starts around 1700 in physics. So it starts with Galileo and Newton. They are kind of the first ones to realize the importance of math. And that really, right before that, we had Aristotle with its four elements, and you had all kinds of alchemy, and people were, right, there was physics, there was chemistry, there were all kinds of sciences, but right, all verbal and all like, well, it's alchemy and looking for the philosopher's stone. And like, there's a really revolution in science after Galileo and Newton, right, that gives rise to Maxwell, Einstein, and quantum mechanics, and to the world, the physics and the world we have today. Other disciplines have seen similar formalization revolutions. Econ, right? Econ as a discipline started later, actually it starts in the 1700s with Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations. And in the late 1800s, like there you get the formalization revolution, Walras, Marshall, and a couple of others start to formalize what they do. And that gives rise like to, especially post the 50s, to the capital asset pricing model that we just saw, Black-Scholes real option pricing models, right? So again, right, a true revolution. And even like these days, like disciplines like biology and medicine, right, are having a revolution. The Human Genome Project actually is like, you need a lot of Bayesian modeling actually to get that to work, protein folding AI. So there seems to be these enormous revolutions happening. And they're truly, like I would say, these are Kuhnian paradigm shifts for these fields, to the point that when we talk theory in physics or in econ, it's equated with formal models, right? In physics, you would never talk about a formal model because like it's, or a computational model, because like any theory is formal. Yeah, actually there's, and in econ similar, actually we can discuss whether that is healthy even, I will come back to that, but certainly that is the status of those fields. In management, right? We're right. The field starts maybe a bit before Porter, but like around 60s, 70s, 80s. We're a young field, and right. If you're a cynic, you could say we're still at the alchemy stage of the field. Though I must, right, it is important to realize, right, that Porter, but also Barney, like they really built on formal theory, like in econ and later, right, like Porter is trained as an economist, but also, for instance, Lippmann and Rimmelt, 82, have a formal theory paper that is one of the pillars of the RBV. And I think there's an interesting question to ask, like what. Why is math actually so unreasonably successful for the sciences, including our own? And I think there's a couple. There's a few reasons for it. One is actually that some people have observed that it appears that the principles of the universe apparently use the language of math. There are some very fundamental principles, for instance. If you think about how cause and effect work, that's encoded in the rules of statistical mechanics. Uncertainty is encoded in probability theory. Certain types of scaling laws, which are a lot used in physics, but also in the social sciences. Evolution, learning, complexity, all seem to follow like all kinds of mathematical rules. And right, sometimes you hear like, okay, but well, math, that's in physics that worked, but social science is way too complex. I'm not sure, right? These principles are true, right? Cause and effect, reasoning. Actually, Christina and Mike, you gave some great examples of these, right? How these apply in social sciences too. It's just more complicated, right? Physics, in a way, is the easy, right? Is the easy one. This is the more complicated. But Christina, right? I'm with you. This is why it's fun. This makes it more fun, right? There's more things for us. To figure out. I think a second really important reason why math is so unreasonably successful is that some things are just too complex for verbal reasoning, right? Newtonian, right? Even Newtonian physics, the certain quantum and relativistic mechanics, these are impossible to do with like verbal reasoning. You need math. The cap M, well, it's probably, I would say, is a boundary thing. I can kind of explain it to my students with very little formal things. Deriving it will be very hard, but you can kind of explain it with some analogies and with some basic principles. You need right, one or two equations, maybe. Real option theory, completely forget it, right? Like, there's no way you're going to derive option theory, like option pricing models, without stochastic dynamics. And you need like solid math for that, right? It's just too complicated to verbally reason through. Competition game theory, very similar story, right? I would say, right? Like things where competition dynamics, probability theory start playing a role, usually very rapidly get too complicated for verbal reasoning. So we need math, and I think there's an important role to play for formal models there. Though there is a danger, right? There is a clear danger, and those are in the assumptions and the boundary conditions, right? Like old garbage in, garbage out applies, right? And any model is a model, right? It is right. The map, I think, is a very apt analogy, and it's always a simplification, and that simplification is built on assumptions. And I think you could say, right? Maybe in econ, there is some argument to be made that some things maybe have become too formal, and in a way. There are sometimes seem, at least to my taste, there seems to be an emphasis on mathematical exactitudes without questioning actually the fundamental assumptions. Like sometimes I joke that economists have started to, right? It's perfectly fine to make assumptions, but economists sometimes seem to, at least some economists seem to start to believe that their assumptions are true, right? And when once you think that, that's I think that is a danger. On the other hand, I think it seems I'm with Mike that management still very much seems to be on the part where there could be much more room for formal theory. We've seen some great examples of that. One area actually where I think there's very important need for more formal theory is in foundations work. This is a picture I took this morning, literally from my backyard. So we live in a new house and they're still constructing things. So I live in Holland, and Holland essentially is built on a swamp. So, right, if you don't do this, like your house will sink in the swamp. So you need the foundations, but like you might not think about these every day, right? Usually you don't see these foundations. You might even think they're pretty boring. But you absolutely need them to not have your house sink into the swamp. And I think there can be some real issues with the foundations of manage, right? But it seems to me the strategic management field is built on some shaky foundations. As an example, right? If you think competitive advantage, rents, resource, what do they really mean? It's unclear. There's all kinds of flaring up debates once in a while, and then they ebb down a bit, but they continue to flare up up to Marvin just very recently had back and forth with Barney and co-authors on the meaning of competitive advantage, and it continues to be unclear. And I think any of the formal people here like pretty much agree that we don't know what these actually means. If you think, by the way, that you have a good idea on what competitive advantage means, I invite you to go back to like this Rumelt paper. It's a Rumelt 03 paper. It's titled "What in the World is Competitive Advantage?" And there's a competitive advantage quiz in there. I think it's a great fun thing to do if you want to be convinced that we have no idea what competitive advantage actually means yet. We teach this to our MBA students all the time. So I very much share, right? Like Mike's, like Eric, right? Like all these old concepts, we use these all the time, but they're actually unclear about the relation. And that has real practical repercussions, right? These are not just some merely theoretical concepts, right? But these are like very practical questions. Rely on these, right? How should you measure firm performance? Well, clearly it's not like most people use return on capital or both in practice or return on assets, even worse, right? In both practice and academia. We know like 40 years already, this is wrong. So actually with my co-author, Nikolai Zygelko, we take a first step at this question. Other practical question, right? If you could make your technology more flexible for free, so broader use, more easy to redeploy, should you always do this? Very practical question. We have a model, a working paper with Tim Volta, Theresa Dickler. Actually, the answer is no. So we have a formal model, and there's actually good reasons in a competitive world why sometimes you should not do this. Broader question, right? What are the MISI in consulting speak, right? The MISI conditions for competitive advantage or for generating rent, right? In an academic language, you could say like, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for these? We have no idea, right? We have no idea because we don't even know what competitive advantage and rents mean actually. So I would say like we really need more formal theory to answer like these very fundamental questions to our field. And so I hope with this short presentation I've convinced you that we actually, right, we need more formal theory in the field. And if you ever find yourself questioning of the role of mathematics in your daily lives, right, think back, think of the centuries of mathematics that were needed to get you to your destination when you drive your car. Thanks so much.
Wonderful, Fibal. Thank you so much for your great thoughts. Very thought provoking and exciting to get these thoughts together from our panelists. I think we've had some interactions that I saw coming by on the chat. While everyone was presenting, you know, I'd like to open up to Q&A to, you know, both, you know, among our panelists, and of course also particularly, you know, for our, you know, for those who are joining in, for our participants here. So anyone who would like to kick off, please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, one question I'd like to pose to my, while we're waiting for the viewers to put their questions in, to my fellow panelists, is the sociological theory we need to promote the theoretical aims that we all talked about. In other words, you know, what pattern of interaction between researchers, learned societies, and practitioners would change the game and enable the ground level theoretical work that we talked about? There seems to be missing something along that dimension.
Yeah. Great question. Great question, Martin. Maybe we can sort of start with that as a thought. Like, so what activities, or, you know, how actually should, how can we use and engage with practice, if I'm translating this well, Martin, please correct me, in order to actually enrich formal theory, right? And vice versa, perhaps, as well. Anyone wants to kind of respond to that? Pick up on that.
I'd be happy to take a stand, and maybe, like, also, like, maybe have some controversial ideas against them. First of all, right, I think, like, all the idea and like having more practitioners in the room. Actually, I used to be a consultant myself. Is that those are certainly useful, though I think, like, we always like to complain, indeed, like, how bad we are at communicating with practice. I'm actually not so sure if actually we, like, it clearly shows we really care about it. And the second thing I will say, right, we teach, like Mike, right, you teach, right, you teach executives, Christina, right, we all teach executives, we teach our MBA students, and to me that is the main conduit for our research to practice. I think that is how this happens, and so to me, indeed, yes, the papers that we write might be sometimes hard to read for practitioners, and I agree we should make every aspiration for others to make them as clear as possible, but a paper can also make an impact if it really makes an impact with other scholars who can use this in their teaching, right? And right, an engineer at Google who makes a GPS doesn't need to understand the Einstein equations, right? And it takes time, right? These things can trickle down. You can have multiple levels. So I think that is important to realize.
And I guess I'm also happy just to follow those comments and agree with them, and also a number of the comments that are coming up in chat. I think that, you know, again, I think my experience with practice is that giving new ideas to business people is not a problem. Business people love new ideas, and especially when you can kind of ground them in some coherent framework that makes sense. But I would feel a lot better as a theorist teaching these ideas if I knew that they were, you know, not flying in the face of more general empirical work, right? I mean, it would. I mean, the whole idea of this interaction is this interaction between theory people and empirical people that seems to happen in all these other fields, but not ours, you know. It is part of the problem. So if I begin to understand, you know, if you start having this dialogue and this virtuous cycle of empirical people testing theories, empirical people finding things that theoretical people want to explain, theories being found to be lacking, and having this improvement in this dialogue the way that you have in other fields, then I'd feel a lot more confident going to practitioners and saying, look, this is, you know, this is really some really solid ideas that we have here. Right now, I can say, here are some ideas that are really internally consistent and logical, you know, and they seem like they fit to the world, but do they, you know, I don't know, the empirical side isn't doing that. And the other thing that I would mention is, and by the way, I just, you know, great presentations. I'm so honored to be among among this group. Martin's comment, I think it was Martin's comment about, you know, how or you know, maybe it was Phoebo's comment about how physics works. So you sort of have physics, and then you have engineers that are sort of engineering scholarship, and then you get the engineering practitioners, and there's a sort of bridge function that happens in other fields. And here, you know, I think we're kind of missing that as well. So where are the people that are going, well, here's some very abstract theory that, you know, Mike Ryle or Adam Brandenburg or somebody's working on that, you know, isn't so clear why it's meaningful to practitioners. But, you know, I'm really good at being the person who sort of can translate that into some very practical, understandable things. Like that's what Michael Porter did. That's exactly right. He took that structure, conduct, performance stuff that was being done in the 60s and turned it into a book and became famous with it, right? But, and he is really good at doing that. He's brilliant at it. You know, I don't know that we have those people. So it's sort of falling on us, you know, the people doing the theory, to sort of be the translators and sort of suggesting the empirical things and, you know, just sort of be a jack of all trades, which takes us away from, you know, what we're actually good at, which is doing the theory. So I think you need that infrastructure, you know, it'd be nice to have that infrastructure as well.
I think in my private comment to Mike, I actually mentioned that Juan Alcazar from HBS did a recent survey of all the strategy syllabi used across different MBA schools, and actually found that the value-based frameworks is a norm, right? Is, you know, taken up by the majority of schools. So in terms of influence and impact, it certainly has made a lot of progress. So, you know, should be proud of what you have achieved. Yeah, I think I want to go back to Phoebo's comment earlier. How have we made impact? For example, in my own teaching to MBA students, I've tried to incorporate some of my research, you know, ideas from my own research, formal or not formal, into the actual syllabus. Right. So if you're learning strategy from me, you're learning, I think, about 30%, 20%. Those content of the entire class is actually uniquely me, right? Uniquely from Christina. So so in that sense, we are trying to individually make an impact, but I'm not sure we can have an infrastructure. How valuable would that be? That maybe, you know, help us to spread out or multiply our individual efforts, because we are all not, we're all specialists, right? We are only good, I mean, I'm only good at building some kind of toy models, but I'm not very good at thinking about empirically testing. But those people who are good at empirical tests, they may not be able to understand what the model is all about, right? So there is an inherent challenge here that we are not able to use multiple methods in our own work, and we're not probably able to be the jack of all trade. That's, I guess, just the inherent challenge faced by the field. Yeah.
Actually, Christina, I'm thinking, it made me think, right, in the physical sciences, right, usually they have actually research, right, you have bigger research teams where actually you have like a theorist and a bit, right, at a CERN or something, right, you have like on any particular paper, there would be theorists and empiricists, actually, that would be one of the ways, maybe,
that's an interesting idea.
Yeah. But then we have sorry, Martin. You go
ahead. I mean, I think the crux of it, from my perspective, is, I mean, there are many nuances to this, but if you ask yourself, you know, what are the minimal interventions that would change the game? I mean, I think something important happens at the point when the research themes are decided. So that's I think, one critical juncture. And maybe that's all about incentives and measuring curiosity and exploration in research. Because the theory has a conservatism in its own right. You know, what keeps the theory moving forwards and the theory funded? And the other one is in the, probably the more critical one is at the point of discussion. I mean, if intelligent people and curious people spanning different disciplines of theory and practice debate things, probably things will get better. Things that are less useful will be deprioritized, and things that are more useful will be prioritized. And so the thought experiment that I like to think about is, you know, if at the next AOM meeting, you know, next year in Boston, 50% of the people there were practitioners, that there were lots of CEOs there because it was a hot discussion. It was something they felt they needed to participate in. That both academics and practitioners felt very gratified and welcome and able to participate. What would that format look like? Because if one could crack the DNA on that I use the word trading zone, if one could crack the DNA on that trading zone, that would transform the game. Because it seems to me that the conditions are extremely conducive, right? I mean, we have any number of new phenomena in strategy that we don't have any sort of theory for at all. I mean, you know, AI and competitive advantage. What's the relationship? You know, the end game economics of AI. What's the relationship? And so there's any number of things that practitioners logically would wish to talk about, but unless we do something to the format, they're not going to show up to our meeting, and eventually, I think that could lead to the decay of the discipline. It doesn't mean the disappearance of this discipline. I think when disciplines die, they become very introverted. They become very self-referential. So maybe another metric of success would be, what would make the physicists and the mathematicians and the computer scientists want to come to this particular meeting because some very sort of hot intersectional conversation were happening?
I think that definitely would be interesting to have more interaction with practitioners. Though I do see one key danger, right? And I would think back, like, would engineers have prioritized Einstein researching general relativity? Right.
That reminds me of somebody who stood up in the Prague SMS conference and opposed the idea of having practitioners involved in the SMS. Because the idea would be they would degrade the quality of the discussions. I think a very controversial point. I mean, there may be a certain sort of short-term truth in it, but I mean, an applied discipline that doesn't connect with practice, surely that is the very definition of irrelevance.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you know, this is an interesting, that this, you know, nicely relays the inherent, I think, ambition and idea behind the session, because I think these, on the one hand, there is the richness that formal theory can offer, and at the other end, there is, you know, the need to remain relevant and how to boundary span those two simultaneously, I think is a very interesting challenge. And I think that, you know, I think we're discussing some of the opportunities here. Are there other thoughts on that, whether from our, you know, panelists or from our participants? Feel free to come in or.
Otherwise, I think we're running out of time, Kunit, and I'm not sure if the audience has more questions for us, but I think it's been a really interesting discussion, and I'm hearing that there are issues both of the field talking to practice, but we also have an issue within the field talking to each other, which I don't know which is more concerning, but they're both of concern. And I posted a comment to Martin in the chat that we're talking about doing an event at AOM in Chicago hosted by STR, where we would have more interaction between practitioners and also the academics. And hopefully that would be an event where everybody would feel welcome, Martin. So I see we have just one question. Tunji, you have a question before we finalize? It has to be a very quick question.
Okay. I mean, just I'll say comment. I'm sitting somewhere in between. I'm just returning to academia after a break from practice, entrepreneurship to be precise. And I'm reacting to a comment by Michael a while back where he said, oh, it feels like we've been talking about this forever. Like, you know, when is this going to happen? And so for me, there are three things. And this is my question. So do you think it's a question of, oh, there's some good work coming out and that is getting rejected on editor's desk, or that the areas of application today are difficult because all the heavy lifting has been, all the easy stuff has been done, and now it's only difficult stuff left to do, or there's lack of interest and in PhDs and in authors? And the reason I ask this is in terms of how do we get to the place where we will see the work we want to see? Do we need to talk to the editors? Do we need to talk to the PhD students? Or maybe it's just to the easy stuff has been done, and it's only difficult stuff left. So that's what I wanted to have this panel, if we have time.
I'll just take a quick shot at that, Tunji. And by the way, it's nice to see you again after all these years. I think the people who are editing the journals can speak to this. My impression is that good theory work, and including some fairly sophisticated formal stuff, gets published in journals. It's sort of startup management science, but you can get it at STR, AMR, and other journals. So I don't think the problem is getting it published. I do think the problem, I think there are two problems. One is that the main problem is, I think, that although people sort of accept that there are people that are doing formal theory, I think the attitude is sort of, look, you guys go over in that corner and talk to each other. You have fun over there, but, we're doing sort of the important stuff over here, and we don't have time to try to figure out how to interpret whatever it is you're doing over there. So I think that's more the problem. In terms of positive solutions, I mean, one thing that I think would be helpful would be some boot camps in this area for PhD students, and maybe even boot camps that include practitioners that come in and say, hey, this is the stuff that's keeping me awake at night. It would sure be nice if I had some general principles about how to deal with this. I would say that for a while I was teaching in the PhD program at the University of Toronto. By the way, I'm at Florida Atlantic University now, so I'm not at Toronto anymore. I've come to where the sunshine is. But one of the things that I did, because all the students were empiricists, is I just said, look, here's what you should do. Write down a formal model. So, you're going to study something empirically, but I just want you to write down the formal model. Now, it doesn't need to be solvable. I just want you to write it down. So define what the objects are. So immediately, if you've got mathematical objects, you have to be precise. So what do you mean by competitive advantage? In some sense, I don't care. I don't feel like there's some true definition of competitive advantage. You just tell me what it is and be clear about that, and then show me why your definition matters, right? And then explain, what are the agent's beliefs? What can they do? What are the consequences? Like, how is the thing set up? And just write it down. I don't care anything. And I had all of those students saying, wow, that was one of the most useful experiences I've ever had. I mean, it really clarified my thinking. So I think there are ways that we can tackle this. But at the moment, we're off in a corner talking to each other and not to a broader audience, which needs to start happening, I think.
Great. Thank you so much, Mike, for and Tunji, for your question. And once again, I'd like to thank the entire, set of panelists and speakers for their wonderful contributions to this STR event.